My name is Karen Stickland, and I'm a maverick up here at Holden. And fortunately, they left me off a little early today so I could get cleaned up for this session. I'm going to talk about why I sat in front of the white train. And for a little bit of an overview, I'm going to talk a little bit about philosophy and nonviolence, and then about some action I have taken. And thirdly, what we as Christians are called to. And I don't think that I have all the answers to that, so I'm going to leave some time for questions at the end. Hopefully you can have some comments or questions. So the definition sheet that I passed around, the first definition is agape or agape. And agape is defined by Martin Luther King Jr. as the love of God operating in the human heart. And there's also a section in 1 Corinthians, which I'll read. They're having a good time over there.
Series board meeting.
Is that what it is, the board meeting?
Board meeting.
Yeah, okay. I understand. In 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verse 4, it says, love is patient. And here we're talking about agape. There's three kinds of love in the Bible, philos and eros and agape. So it's talking about agape is patient and kind. Love is not jealous or boastful. It is not arrogant or rude. Love does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable or resentful. It does not rejoice at wrong, but rejoices in the right. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. And then it goes on, and then verse 13, so faith, hope, love abide, these three, but the greatest of these is love. And you probably hear that a lot, that particular scripture, maybe at weddings in particular, but I think if we can look at freshly, it can have some meaning for us, at least for me. That particular verse is part of the agape statement. Ciel Agape is a group of about 14 people who meet weekly in Seattle. And we begin each meeting with prayer and reflection because we think that's real important for us to be able to carry out the work that we do. We also meet with Ground Zero Center for Nonviolent Action. And some of you may have heard of that. It was founded by Jim and Shelley Douglas as a response to the Trident submarines that were to be based at Bangor, Washington, and are based at Bangor. There's this rough map that I drew here. It's very rough. Bangor is way up here in the corner, for those of you not familiar with Washington. The philosophy of nonviolence is, for me, it's basically the philosophy of the gospel. Growing up, I always heard the stories of the gospel, the Good Samaritan, and stories like turn the other cheek and love your enemy. And I understand those words to mean what they say, to turn the other cheek and to love my enemy. And I think sometimes it's easy to skip over those and say, well, Jesus didn't really mean that. I mean, not that we were actually supposed to love our enemies like the Soviet Union and to not kill people. He couldn't have meant that. But I think that's what he did mean. And I don't think they were just using filler to fill up a few extra pages in the gospel. And that's this along the same lines of what Gandhi taught and tried to practice in India. Some of you, how many people saw the movie Gandhi? Anybody? Gandhi engaged in a practice of nonviolence in an attempt to replace the British government in India, which was a British colony. And he didn't want to do it violently. He didn't want to do it with guns. He wanted to be able to do it with love and compassion for the British as well as for the Indians who were oppressed by the British. And it's the same way that Martin Luther King operated, Martin Luther King Jr. in the South. They began a campaign of civil disobedience so that the blacks could have the right to even sit down on buses. And they did that by simply sitting in the buses and not by assaulting the white people, whom they were very angry with. They had a right to be angry with, but they tried to operate in a way of nonviolence, the spirit of agape. and quite successfully, I think. So, let's see. There are a couple of leaflets here. At Seattle Agape also leaflets every Tuesday morning at Burlington Northern headquarters. And that some of those leaflets are around the fireplace area here. One of them is called The Power of Love, and another one is a leaflet that we passed out at Christmas time, which is called Beyond Santa Claus, because we feel that sometimes at Christmas people forget what Christmas means. So you might pick up a couple of those. And I think I'm kind of a practical person, and so besides the fact that I think that nonviolence is what I'm called to, I think that it works. I think that the power of nonviolence is greater than any other power that we can choose or that we know of. And actually that it's even greater than the power of nuclear weapons. I think in this country, we have placed a lot of trust in nuclear weapons. We depend on nuclear weapons to defend us and to create security for us. And I feel like they don't create security for me. I worry about it. And I think as an alternative, the power of love and the power of nonviolence is much greater than any weapon that we can ever conceive of. And so it's a matter of harnessing that power. And although it's not just strictly a matter of harnessing it, because I can't use the power of nonviolence unless I live the power of nonviolence. And that's what I try to do. I don't always succeed, obviously. Sometimes I think that I shouldn't be drinking coffee because coffee is a cash crop and people in Central America are growing coffee beans when they could be growing food and so on and so forth. So that's one example of the way that I'm not succeeding in that, in what I believe is a nonviolent way to act. But I continue to try to employ the power of nonviolence and to use it. And sometimes, as in the days of Gandhi and Martin Luther King, that means that individuals risk their lives, and sometimes that means that individuals lose. This isn't a guaranteed way of success, the power of nonviolence. That means sometimes people die, and people die in war too. But overall, I think the overall effectiveness of nonviolence is much greater than the war. When we look in history, wars have continued. There's wars in, well, say, just take Central America. There's violence on one side, and then there's violence on the other side, and the same with South Africa, and the violence continues and escalates. And so I think that, although I can't say what those people would do or what I would do if I was in their situation, I can say that it doesn't seem like that's working, and that maybe there's another thing we have to try, and maybe that thing is the gospel that Jesus preached to us. So all this is kind of an explanation for the sort of actions I've taken. And I'm trying to begin with the power of nonviolence rather than to begin with it's an anti-nuclear protest, because the anti-nuclear actions that I've taken have grown out of the nonviolence. And we just happen to have focused our attention on that particular area of violence, the area of nuclear weapons. In 1983, well, first of all, in 1982, a reporter first spotted a train. It was painted white. It had gun turrets. It was labeled ATMX. And he called up Jim Douglas and asked Jim Douglas if he knew what it was. And I mentioned earlier, Jim Douglas is the founder of Ground Zero Center for Nonviolent Action. And so Jim looked at some documents from the Washington State Department of Utilities, the Washington State Department of Utilities Commission, and found such a train described, a train that would be painted white, it would have gun turrets, it would be marked ATMX, and ATMX stands for the Atomic Energy Commission, and the X is because there is no particular railroad like Burlington Northern or Northern Pacific that owns that car. And that train was to carry nuclear warheads. And Jim and others traced that train back to Pantex. And Pantex is in Amarillo, Texas, just outside Amarillo, Texas. And it just so happens that Amarillo, Texas is Pantex is the final assembly point for all nuclear weapons in the United States. So that's where that terrain would originate. So the warheads were transported from Pantex to Bangor, Washington, and roughly along that route. That's the most recent route. There's also a map here of the TRACS campaign that's much more detailed and much more accurate than I can draw on the big board. The other place that the train has been tracked to is to Charleston Naval Weapons Station on the East Coast. And in 83, in March of 83, we saw a train leave the Pantex plant. There were people there watching for the train and people watching all along the route of the train. And so I, along with five others, decided to sit in the path of that train as an expression of our horror at the cargo that it carried, and because we felt that as American citizens and as taxpayers that we were partially responsible. We are responsible for the weapons that are carried and delivered and deployed. So that we sat in front of the tracks, in front of the train that day, and Kitsap County Sheriff's officers pulled us off the tracks, and we were arrested. The train didn't stop itself. It continued slowly into the Bangor base. And I was tried before a jury and found guilty and spent 8 days in Kitsap County Jail. The judge gave us an option of paying a fine of $200, but I didn't feel like I had done anything wrong, and I certainly didn't want to contribute to the prison system, so that I chose to spend those 8 days in jail instead. And that's almost a whole story in and of itself, but I'm going to move on to some more recent things too. Just a little bit of information about the Trident submarine. It's an enormous submarine, and Robert Aldridge was one of the people that helped design the submarine and the submarine system. And he since resigned from his position at Lockheed and wrote a book called First Strike, in which he describes the Trident submarine as a first strike weapon, negating our commonly understood theory that the U.S. has a defensive system. He's saying, this is a first strike weapon. We're designing this because of its incredible accuracy and the power. We can destroy the Soviet missiles in their silos. And so that he talks about the Pentagon's policy of a first strike policy. And I'm not sure if that's in the bookstore or not, but if you're interested in that, you might want to read it. It's pretty technical, I think, on different aspects of the Trident system. After while I was in jail and afterwards, I began to read more about the philosophy of nonviolence and more about the technical aspects and about the legal aspects of the nuclear arms race. And one of the things that in the Seattle Agape community we've talked a lot about lately is the Nuremberg obligation, our Nuremberg obligation. After World War II, the victorious Allies tried German war criminals for crimes against peace and crimes against humanity. And people were convicted of crimes against peace, even though they were ordered by their superiors to carry out certain tasks. Nuremberg established that individuals are responsible for what they do. And that should be kind of familiar to us as Christians, because I think we are responsible for our individual actions, regardless of whether somebody tells us to do something. In the end, we're responsible. Mary Kaufman has testified at various trials. She was an assistant prosecutor at Nuremberg. And this leaflet here has a quote from her, which I'll read. Mary Kaufman explains, "We have adopted a principle which says you have to interpose your estimate of the conduct and not simply obey. This came out of the excesses of the Nazi regime. It came out of the fact that the death trains went by and nobody looked, nobody saw. It came out of the fact that there was a tremendous silence and that the assembly line of death, destruction, and dehumanization in Nazi Germany was furthered by many and protested by few." She says that silence is complicity as well. So because of that and because of our understanding of international law, which prohibits weapons of mass destruction, we believe that the Trident First Strike system is illegal under international law. And because of that, recent actions that we've taken, we've called Nuremberg actions instead of civil disobedience, which is a term that people have used in the past. So that by sitting in front of a train, we're not trying to change a particular law, like Martin Luther King and those people were trying to change laws that were observed. And we're not protesting necessarily against trespass laws. We're protesting against the system, the Trident system. The other thing that I came to learn more about was the spiritual implications of us as individuals and our nation building these weapons. Because I believe that even if we don't ever use these weapons, and so far, well, since Hiroshima and Nagasaki, we haven't used any nuclear weapons. But what we're doing is we're continuing to build the weapons, and we're continuing to pay for them, and basically we're agreeing with each other. Maybe it's just by our silence. We're agreeing that it's okay to destroy millions of people in order to protect ourselves. And I simply don't think that I'm that important, that I have the right to destroy another nation and to threaten the world just because I feel insecure or because I think the Soviet Union might fire first. I don't think I have a right to hold the whole world hostage by the nuclear arsenal that we possess now. And I think it's pretty clear that when somebody murders another person, that's wrong. And I think that's accepted almost worldwide as far as I know. But then when it's a mass murder, such as what would happen with nuclear arms, then that's okay, or we justify that because it's self-defense. And I can't justify that to myself. I think if murder is wrong with an individual, then it's certainly at least as wrong when we're considering the murder of another nation. And because of the theories about nuclear winter that we know about now, that actually we're threatening the entire world with a nuclear arsenal. So after more consideration, I took another action in 1985. And by 1985, the nuclear train had been painted. I think I have some pictures here that I'll pass around if I can find them. Yeah, they're marked. And they're marked on the back. By 85, the nuclear train had been painted, and basically I think it was because the Department of Energy felt that it was, obviously it was too highly visible. And that's true, because the train had been going since about 1960, and no one had really noticed it, although it's very, very noticeable. When you see the pictures, you'll wonder how people could miss it. But finally, the Department of Energy painted the train. The white paint was supposedly to help maintain an even temperature with inside the cars. So I guess they decided that the lower visibility was more important than that. So in 85, I sat in front of the train again with 19 other people. And once again, we told the jury that yes, we sat in front of this train. And yes, I heard the sheriff tell me to move. And no, I did not move. And this time the jury's reaction was different, and we were very surprised to be acquitted. The jury found us not guilty. Suzanne Smith, who was one of the jurors, later said that she simply didn't believe that we had committed a crime by what we had done. And I was helping to defend myself during that case, and I gave the closing statement, closing arguments. And there were 19 other people, so I was pretty nervous about what I was going to say, because I was feeling like, wow, if I say the wrong thing, then we'll all go to jail. And, you know, it's kind of heavy pressure. But then I thought about it for a while. I took a walk and decided that I didn't have to say the right thing. And what I had to do was to say the truth, as I understood it. And that if we went to jail, we went to jail. We didn't. But that all I could do was try to speak the truth. And then the pressure came off of me, and I think that's one of the reasons that we were acquitted, because everybody in the courtroom was trying to tell the truth of the of their own stories and about why they had done what they had done. That was in February. The action was in February of 85, and the trial was in the summer of 85. Since then, the train has mostly been going to the East Coast, to the Charleston Naval Weapons Station there. And Seattle Agape and the Agape communities began when people started tracking missile mortar trains. Missile mortars are the solid rocket fuel for the warheads. And they're transported from Salt Lake City, and they come up to Bangor. And these are manufactured under a joint contract by Hercules and Morton Thiokol. Morton Thiokol, the same people that made the rocket motors for the shuttle that exploded. So we've begun to track those again, and there have been four times this summer that people have sat in front of those trains. And the county prosecutor is not prosecuting, at this time is not prosecuting people. He says that it's a federal train going to a federal base, has federal material in it, so it's federal responsibility. And the Navy says they don't want the responsibility, and the federal government says they don't want the responsibility. So at this time, no one is prosecuting the people. On Monday, there were 11 people arrested last Monday, and I don't know yet whether they've pressed charges against those people. I think what we're trying to do is continue to act so that somebody does take the responsibility. We really think that it is probably more the federal government's responsibility than Kitsap County. But in the past, Kitsap County has done the prosecuting. So that's one of the other things that we're continuing to do, is to track those missile mortar trains. And we also, I'm a part of a training committee that helps train people that are considering sitting in front of a train. And we ask people to spend at least a day and sometimes a weekend reflecting on what their motivation is. We ask them questions like, why are you doing this? Are you trying to escape from something? And then we also go over the legal consequences of the action. It's 90 days for trespass, and we've been charged with conspiracy to trespass, which is an additional 90 days. Blocking a train is 90 days, and there's always other charges. So we ask people that are considering sitting in front of a train or taking other actions similar to that to be able and to be willing to serve the full time, because we don't really know what the consequences will be. And like I said, we leaflet every week at Burlington Northern headquarters, and that's because Burlington Northern is the railroad responsible for hauling the train into Bangor. Burlington Northern, there's been a mixed response from the people at Burlington Northern. Some of the people will no longer take leaflets, and some people thank us for what we've done. We pass about 2,000 every week, because there are also downtown business people that take the leaflets. Somebody said last Tuesday, she came up and she told a leafleter that she was the wife of somebody that works at Trident, and these leaflets are the only thing that give her hope. We did a survey about a year ago, and we got 150 responses approximately. People mailed them in, and that was the single most frequent response, was that the leaflets give them hope, which in some ways it's a big responsibility. We're just by passing out these leaflets every week, just by that little thing, we're giving that many people hope. And it also shows me that probably a lot of people don't have very much hope for the situation that we're facing now. We speak to different groups, and we show a film called The Arms Race Within, which was made about a year ago, which unfortunately I don't have with me. I think it would be interesting to show. Right now, we're preparing for the coming of the 8th Trident submarine, the Alaska, which we believe will arrive at Bangor, the submarine base, towards the end of October. And probably we're going to do something the last Sunday in October, which is Reformation Sunday. And hopefully some church people have been pretty supportive, actually, will help us with that. The bishop from Alaska, the Catholic bishop from Alaska, is coming down because of his, he has strong feelings about the Trident submarine, especially this one, because it's named the Alaska. So, and then there's one thing that I wanted to mention about, people ask us a lot of time, is what you do, is it effective? And I think there are a couple answers to that. One is yes, I do think it's effective because I see individual changes, mostly in individuals. One of the prosecutors for a trial that helped prosecute and convict some people volunteered to help with a trial that I was in. And he wanted to help defend us because he really believed that what we were doing, he said it was one of the most important things he'd ever done, was to help defend us. So in small ways like that, I see many changes in people. And I think that that's the way that change can and will come about. Then the other answer to the question is, are we effective, is I'm not sure that that matters, because I think that I'm called to do what I'm called to do, and whether it's effective or not, I continue to do it. And if I believe that it's a way of living out the gospel, then I continue to do it, and maybe I don't know whether it's effective or not, and maybe it's not. But I think I have to continue to do it, because if I didn't, knowing what I know, both legally and morally, I think I'd be a hypocrite. In our house, we have a poster, and it's a black poster, and it just has a streak of lightning down the middle, a white streak of lightning, and at the bottom are the words, "It's a sin to build a nuclear weapon." And I'm not a theologian, and I'm not really sure I can say what that means. What does sin mean? But I know that for myself as an individual, I couldn't build a nuclear weapon. And so I'm wondering, what does it mean for us as Christians? That we know, we realize that nuclear weapons are potentially devastating for the world. And we may say that we may be able to justify them in some ways. But I think by looking at the gospel, we'd have to say that nuclear weapons are wrong. And I think we'd have to say that even being silent about nuclear weapons is wrong. And I think that paying for nuclear weapons is also wrong. And I'm not sure I can use the term sin, because I don't know. I really don't know how we would define the term sin. But like I said before, if murder is wrong, then surely mass murder is wrong. And so that's one of the things I wanted to ask people about. What's your response to that? What is it that we have to do as Christians? Again, after Nuremberg, the Germans, many Germans said they didn't know, or that they had to do what they did because they were told to. In some cases, that's probably true, because many people would have been, probably they would have been killed for cooperating, for refusing to cooperate with the Nazis. Somebody's going past. So then, that's one of the questions I want to ask. What is a corporate body of Christ? Are we called to do? And before we go into that, I just wanted to point out some of these books. There's a, well, it's something that Sojourner sent out, A Matter of Faith, and it's a study guide for churches that people might be interested in. It's in the bookstore. There's also a book by, well, it's, I guess you'd call it a book, by Daniel Erlander.
He calls it a booklet.
A booklet. By Faith Alone, A Lutheran Looks at the Bomb.
Bestseller
in the bookstore. Waging Peace by Jim Wallace, I think, is a real good beginning book to read, because it has a lot of different articles about what we're called to do. Lightning East to West is a book by Jim Douglas that talks about the nuclear arms race, and specifically about what we're involved in a nonviolent campaign. And he also has another book, The Nonviolent Cross, and this is only $1.95 because it's an old one, it's a good deal, which is more theologically oriented. Might be a little thick to get through, it was for me. So, and those are just a few of the books. There's a lot more in the bookstore, and there's also a lot of tapes in the tape library. And then there's one other thing I wanted to pass around. There's Ground Zero sends out, this is a newspaper, they call it a newspaper, every 2 months or so. And the subscription price is what people can pay. So if you're interested in receiving this, I'll send this around and you can sign up to receive it. Now, it's only 4:30, but I'm kind of done, so maybe we could have open it to questions or discussion.
Where did you actually sit on the sacrificial, just before they entered the naval base?
Just shortly before the naval base, right. Right, we told the Sheriff's Department and Burlington Northern Railroad that we would be doing that. Lately, Burlington Northern has refused to meet with us, so we haven't been able to talk to them very much. Because that's part of our nonviolent philosophy, that we're open with people, and which puts us to a lot of risk. Certainly a lot of people could come in and try to disrupt an action like that. But we try to be open about what we're doing. There's the film is called The Arms Race Within.
When I saw that, it was really interesting based on that question, how you people engage the sheriff and the other people who are around there and just kind of was ministering to them in a very, you know, it's what gentle justice is all about. You know, it's just a very gracious time talking to them, how's your kids, how so-and-so, you know, and just being friends with them during this time. Train is coming down closer and closer and trying to track where it is, and we have to sit out here, you know, for another 2 hours or 2 days and who knows where it is and all these things. I think it's marvelous. I asked John Nelson basically the same question that Chris asked you, and he says, when you have to ask a question, you are no longer called. You're not called yet to do that. That it's not a question of when can I do it, when can't you not do it. It's a question. Something that you just have to do it for a spiritual renewal. I have the same question.
We do try to engage both Burlington Northern and the Sheriff's Department in conversation. The Sheriff, Ground Zero, every week they have a Wednesday night speaker, and the Sheriff has come out and spoken there and talked about how he feels about the train actions, and we've invited Burlington Northern to come out, and so far they have not agreed to it. But both the Sheriff and the Undersheriff have come out, and we've asked some former prosecutors to come out, and they've spoken as well. Well, the most recent one, Pat, was Chuck Wheeler, the undersheriff, and he didn't try to discourage us. I think he knows us well enough not to try and discourage people. He mostly talked about how he felt about it, the cost to the county, the fact that he personally thought that we needed the weapons. That's what I mean.
I've seen him like maybe the show was like, how long did you stay?
Well, the first time, not very long, because we went out and sat in front of the train as it approached. And then we were taken off the tracks before the train came to where we were. The second time, we went out about 20 minutes ahead of time and waited. We knew where the train was because someone down the line was watching, and they called us when it passed their house. So it was about 20 minutes. And then we were arrested. Right. Jeff, did you have a question? Well, that was something we talked a lot about, especially the first time, because we didn't know what would happen. And up until the last day, I didn't really know what I would do. And I thought I would probably stay there. And when it actually occurred, then I know I would have remained there because I was completely at peace sitting on the tracks. And had I not been removed, I would have stayed. Well, I don't know for sure, probably. The trains can't always stop. I think it probably will.
The first time you announced the fact that I would think the people on the train knew full well. So,
right, we announced it, and the sheriff's department was out there.
anything else publicly you want to know?
I just did talk to somebody about it too.
Ironic thing is their caring is so much more destructive than any other one person.
When you were acquitted the second time, did you hear from, you mentioned the one woman on the jury, you mentioned the guilty. Did you hear from others or what the conversation has been as to why you were convicted? It must have gone considered beyond the strict trespassing law, or what?
Well, that we were charged with entering and remaining unlawfully. So we talked about, we got to talk a little bit about why we remained unlawfully. The judge, in any case like this, really limits the testimony that you can give. We weren't allowed to testify about international law, for example, or necessity. So we got to talk about our state of mind, which was enough in this case. But any jury has the right to find someone not guilty, regardless of what the law is or what it says. It was back in the 1700s that was established when a judge tried to overturn a jury's acquittal. A jury acquitted some people. The judge says, no, you can't do that. But the law upheld the jury, because the jury is a jury of your peers, and they have the final say. And if we're acquitted by a jury, it can never be appealed. That's it. The jury has the final word. And not very many people know about it. It's called jury nullification. And the judge doesn't want to talk about it either. So that's somewhat what happened that day. And one of the people said that he didn't think we were guilty from the beginning. And someone else said that there were a lot of people on the tracks, so everybody should have been arrested. That was the press and so forth. But some of these reasons were things that we had never brought out. People in the jury tried to think of reasons. Basically, they tried to think of reasons to oppose.
It sounds like basically they knew that you were in personal law, but they just didn't feel it was wrong. Is that accurate?
No, because I don't believe that we broke the law. I believe that we were upholding international law.
I understand that.
But otherwise, it's accurate.
Specific law of trespassing.
Yeah.
But they just felt that what you were doing was right morally, and that's what they wanted to do.
Basically, yeah.
So you were being righteous and ratchet.
That's what the jury thought, yeah, I guess so.
Teacher Fern, I don't know if all of you were at the Bible study this morning, but there would be interesting talk. Sometimes to be righteous is not to do the right thing. You can do a thing that in society may be considered wrong, but can be actually righteous and be the right thing.
Are there people that that would argue with me that nuclear weapons are okay, or you know, I really wonder. It seems pretty audacious of me to say to build a nuclear weapon is a sin, because I don't. It seems to me personally it is, but then I'm also saying that about others that are doing the same thing. Is there somebody that can help me with that? Well, or is that true? Is that true or not?
Why do you target specifically nuclear weapons? Why not M16 rifle?
Well, I feel the same way about
tanks.
Yeah, I feel the same way about M16 rifles. Probably we think of nuclear weapons because the destruction that they're capable of is so much more immense.
I agree that destruction is pretty important. But all the weapons have the same kind of purpose.
Well, the distinction some people have is conventional warfare can end life, but nuclear warfare can end all potential life and future life. I'm not sure if you want to follow your statement. like that, but I think you're not saying that.
Yeah, that's not
life
what I'm
is
saying.
Life.
Although many people hold that position.
Mm-hmm.
I feel this way and act this way against nuclear weapons because I can't act this way on every issue. And there are many issues. You know, Central America is a big issue currently, and so is South Africa, but I can't do all those things. So. Is there any other?
I'm thinking of the way, I mean, there are good things that nuclear, not nuclear weapons, but nuclear power is used. The same as electricity, but if they are misused, they are killing. So is it the way they're used? I'm not thinking of weapons, but I mean the use of nuclear power or electricity or gas or mining or these things.
Yeah. Nuclear power is kind of in a different category because I can't think of a good use for nuclear weapons. And I think the biggest problem with nuclear power is the waste problem.
Yeah.
That it doesn't seem anybody has solved. And for that reason, I can't support nuclear power.
That should be settled before the...
It's interesting, just before they. You know, we're so easy to point and say they.
I know.
What I hear you saying is that if we start saying us, then it moves you to vote no in a very real way. But as long as I can keep saying they, I'm not called to that. And once they start saying us, it changes the whole concept.
Yeah. What I heard, you know, democracy, everyone pulls the trigger.
What's happening in Texas around the plant? Do you need
there? They vigil there every Monday. There's a small group of people that vigil there. It's a fairly conservative area. And then people also watch the train when it leaves. And we have an elaborate phone network all up and down the tracks. There was a comment or question back there?
Yeah, I was going to say, I guess for me, I do make a distinction between nuclear weapons and 16, and also between nuclear power and hydroelectric power. And I really think we've reached a point in history where the same arguments no longer apply, but we were still using the same arguments. I mean, Albert Einstein said that when the bomb was dropped, everything changed except the way we thought. And I think that's true, that we still think of things sort of purely in sort of a decision analysis way in terms of the effectiveness and the efficiency without realizing that our technology of doing things has far surpassed our knowledge of what the effects are. And that things are so absolutely different with nuclear power and with nuclear weapons that the effects are just so far beyond anything we can possibly imagine that we can no longer just sort of take what has in the past been a value-free scientific approach to everything. And so though we just can keep going on and on and on, experimenting, and that's the way we've always done things, and if we hadn't done that with steam power, we wouldn't be where we are, and if we hadn't done that with other kinds of power, we wouldn't be where we are. But I think at some point we have to say that knowledge is no longer the priority, and that we're not going to solve all of our technical problems simply by trying to find out more. That the risks of that are now too great. That we're going to destroy everything before we find a solution, if there is one. And I think at some point we have to say that life is underlying all of this, and it's a priority above and beyond having more efficient power or having supposedly some kind of peaceful return.
There's also one other comment that I wanted to make is that by acting in the way that I have, it's given me hope. And I think that taking some action in regards to the nuclear arms race or or to Central America or South Africa, it does give people hope. Because if you're hopeless, then you might as well just go away and forget the whole thing. But taking the actions, I think, is a sign of hope.
Then one of the groups that you're involved with is actually like
Well, we don't exactly have a real long-term plan, five-year plan, but as people are interested in going on the tracks, we easily talk to them about, like I said, about motivation, about the legal consequences. We ask them to act in a nonviolent spirit. And so that weeds some people out. Some people aren't willing to do that. Some people want to tell the cops off and cuss them out. And they feel maybe they should maybe hit a few of them, so on and so forth. And so it reduces our numbers in that way. But what we'd like to see is more people, probably more people on the tracks, more people either resisting by means of taxes, by the war tax. Tim Kieschbeek talked about that. That's on tape in the library about war tax resistance. More people speaking out against nuclear weapons. And I think what people do depends on what they do. I mean, each individual, you can read and then pray and reflect on what you can do. And I think there are a lot of different things. Education, educating yourself is probably the first one.
I wanted to challenge you about one thing.
Okay.
You said earlier. And that's what you said about when you asked the question to be effective or not.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to challenge you about your analysis that it is effective and that you've seen effect. That's the part I agree with. But the second part that you said, in some sense, it doesn't matter whether it's effective or not.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I'd like to challenge. I do think that sometimes we will choose to do things that are totally ineffective because it's the only thing to do and we have to do something. But I get worried about, it seems to me that, speaking about the Lutheran Church, my church, is that first of all, it's hard enough to get people to act. But then when they finally do act, a lot of times they will act only as martyrs almost. They won't ask the question, what can we do that's most effective? They'll do something that's dramatic or something that kind of reinforces the fact that they're kind of a righteous remnant that's left kind of fight against the big beast.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that ultimately it becomes very discouraging to most of the people that are involved and people kind of drop away. I think that within any cause, and certainly within the cause of fighting against nuclear, further nuclear armament and so forth, there are a lot of options. There are many things we could do. And so it's necessary to ask, well, what are some of the most effective options? Just for the longevity of the cause, people, I think, in order to keep going, have to feel like they're doing something. One last thing, if God calls us to be righteous and act righteously, I'm sure God does, it seems to me God also calls us to be as effective as possible. What's the virtue in attempting to be righteous and be oblivious to what will actually bring God in us? So, being a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's a good point, but I shouldn't say that. That implies that I'm going to disagree with you now. I guess, it's not like we do sit down and we strategize and we think, well, what are we going to do now? It's not like we just go out and, well, this isn't going to work, but we're going to do it. So we do. We spend a lot of time in meetings discussing what we should do next.
Do you know of anything that might be more effective than just the thing you think?
I don't know of what would be more effective. But that doesn't really answer your question of why I would say that it doesn't matter if it's effective. I guess maybe more than saying it doesn't matter, it's more accurate for me to say I don't know if it's effective. And I don't really, you know, I never know all the implications of the actions. And I think that's probably more accurate for me to say.
Even not knowing the effective is still meaningful to you.
Yeah.
Can I take a shot at that?
Sure.
Because that's something that I wrestle with a lot too. I think my feeling is that I think we are called to be both righteous and effective, and you do everything you can to be effective, but then you don't base your continuation of what you're doing totally on some analysis of whether it's effective or not. In other words, you just simply act trusting that you have looked at all the possibilities for you in your particular setting and that you are trying to be effective, but then you go on and you don't depend. I think we totally depend on absolutely concrete effectiveness, and then how do we decide what that is? And I also don't think that you always sort of have to look at it in terms of what is the most effective thing, because if you look at that in terms of a corporate body of Christ, then everybody's doing different things, and effectiveness might be very intensely with one or two people on one hand, and it might be effective, something else might be effective for hundreds of people in a less intense way, and everybody's got to do their part, and effectiveness is something that takes, you know, it's very different places, and if everybody's working together, then that makes a difference. So.
I think you're effective when you get on the TV and you get on the newspaper and you get on the radio stations, and you've done that. And so I think that you are effective because you get out and that's what people hear in the news, and so they know what's happening. And when they stop doing that because of not putting them into jail, then they're trying to make it not as important, that they're ignoring what you're trying to do. And so I have a funny feeling that if that happens again, you're going to find something else to raise you up again into the news.
It's almost 5 o'clock, so maybe if there's one more thing somebody wants to say, and then Mike.
I just spent 3 weeks with some convicts, and when we discussed things like whether something was effective, they really would change the discussion to what they wanted to talk about, which was being consistent with your ends and your means. They talked about lifestyle, and for me it was real important because you really don't see those big victories, and they said that wasn't as important. I mean, they're very effective without a doubt in what they do, but for them it was their lifestyle. It wasn't a matter of we have to look and see what's going to happen at the end, and whatever happens to get us there is important. We have to achieve that goal. That wasn't their discussion at all, and to me it seemed real consistent. I think it's real consistent with what I've heard about.